from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
This case is about the widening corruption of elite college admissions through the steady application of wealth combined with fraud.
That was U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling earlier this week announcing the college admissions scam that has rocked some of the nation's top schools, including Stanford University, and has implicated more than a dozen Bay Area parents. We'll talk about the latest developments and what the scandal says about merit and college access. And we want to hear from you. Has the scandal changed your views about the U.S. higher education system? That's all next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 13 Bay Area parents and a Stanford sailing coach were among the 50 people charged Tuesday in a major college admissions bribery scheme. The indictment alleges that suspects paid standardized test proctors to doctor their children's results and bribed college coaches to recruit kids who had never played a sport to gain entrance to schools such as Stanford, USC, and Yale. In this hour, we're going to talk about the scam, and we want to hear from you. What do you think it says about the state of higher education in the United States? And you can call us now at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. Number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And here with me to discuss all this is Leonardo Castaneda, who joins us in studio. He's a reporter for the Mercury News, Bay Area News Group, who's been following this story and writing about it. And welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Paul Franz, who joins us as well, research associate at Challenge Success. They're a nonprofit school reform organization, and they focus on student well-being and engagement with learning. And welcome to the program, Paul Franz.
Thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Julie Lithcott-Hames and welcome her. She's the author of How to Raise an Adult and Real American and former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. And Leonardo, I'm going to begin with you. This is, over a dozen Bay Area parents that have been implicated in getting through what's described as the side door here, getting college entrance through fraud or deception and cheating, really. And the rage of many people at this is something I want to talk about with our guests this morning. But we have to go back a little bit to the history, and let's do that with you. We go back to 2011. A guy named Rick Singer, California man, sets up this front charity actually to conceal bribes and paying for tests and cheating and fake athletic recruitment and all the rest of it.
Right. So he sets up this company, which, you know, college preps, test prep, it's not uncommon. It's a pretty big industry. But he figures out, you know, what he calls this side door, like you said, which is not, you know, the front door, you apply, you get in. The back door is, you know, you make some massive donation, you build a new dorm, and, you know, you get a second look, you maybe get a little bit of leeway on your application.
So the Jared Kushner way of getting in.
Yeah. Right. That's kind of the poster boy that a lot of people have pointed to. You know, you make a couple million dollars, maybe get a wing of the library named after you, and maybe your kid gets a little bit of help, a little bit of a second look. But this side door is, one is, you know, these fake tests, either having someone correct the tests, in some cases having someone take the test for the kid and just kind of cutting out the middleman, which in this case happens to be the actual student who will be going to the school. And in some cases, using the student-athlete points. You know, the schools have certain spots that they can give because they want to have some of the best athletes in some of these sports like rowing and crew.
They're minor sports usually, though. It's not like basketball and football, which get the major spotlight.
Right. And I think that, you know, it might be because it's harder, you know, to convince those coaches. Those coaches are under a lot of pressure to perform. You know, maybe a sailing coach or a tennis coach has maybe a little bit more leeway where they say, well, if I don't get one of my top recruits, or, you know, if I use up one of these spots, I'll still be okay. I'll still have, you know, great student athletes.
And they give them spots. I mean, this is pretty much a phenomenon that's been going on for years. I'm talking about
right.
What would be described as the minor sports.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they give them spots. And you know, that's how for a lot of students, they view that as a way to get into college. This is, you know, a totally legitimate way to secure your spot in a great school. But these students, a lot of them either weren't performing the sport at all. You know, there were some cases where a parent in the indictment was worried that his kid might be forced to actually play water polo. Or, you know, they wildly overinflated their achievement in the sport. There was one where, you know, the student did play tennis. They presented the student as these great national level recruit. And I think at their peak, they were ranked something like 207th in the Northern California under 12 division. So not necessarily the top of the game. But, you know, they use that to get a spot.
But we're talking really about a major criminal enterprise, racketeering enterprise, 50 people in six states. And the Justice Department operated a sting, really, on this whole scam called Operation Varsity Blues and got all kinds of charges going. But I mentioned Rick Singer. I mean, obviously, he was cooperating with them. They were taping these conversations and so forth that he had with these people who hired him.
Absolutely. And those taped calls are pretty illuminating. He goes into a lot of details with the parents, presumably to get them to fess up to their arrangement, where he explains, you know, I gave this money to this individual, you're going to make $150,000 to the USC Women's Athletics Department, and in exchange, your daughter is going to be given a spot on the soccer team, let's say. And the parents were pretty clear-eyed. And what's interesting in those calls as well is they, you know, for the most part, they repeat, you know, I don't want my son to know, I don't want my daughter to know. So it shows that a lot of the times this was parent-led. Not always. There are a couple cases where it seems like the kids knew what was going on.
But the kids have not been charged. The universities haven't been charged. We just have really the parents at this point who
correct.
Are being charged. And this is racketeering conspiracy, fraud conspiracy, money laundering conspiracy, obstruction of justice. I mean, there are a lot of serious charges here. And you wonder, you know, are some of these, especially more famous people, especially the celebrities from Hollywood, Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman, are they going to actually do time?
We'll have to see, wait and see. You know, it's I think in all of these cases, when folks have access to a strong legal defense, let's say, you know, they might manage to pay a fine.
Money can play a lot of roles in the courtroom. You're absolutely right about that. But you've also going to have charges up against some really you cover the South Bay. You got some pretty heavy hitters there. I mean, you got some people who are really quite famous in terms of not only in the South Bay, but throughout the Bay Area. The name Bill McGlashlin has come up a good deal, who's in Mill Valley. Private equity group that ironically is all about ethics and helping people who are down and out.
Right. Yeah, we have the celebrities that are widely popular, but some of these people are, you know, very highly respected in their given field. You have, like you said, Bill, who is seen as this kind of ethical investing guru, who is not acting necessarily the most ethically, at least according to these allegations. You have, you know, Manuel Enriquez, who's the CEO of Hercules Capital, another kind of large investment firm in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. So these are, you know, these are power players in their industry. These aren't just your kind of run-of-the-mill upper-middle-class folks.
No, we're talking about major investors and, in many instances, entrepreneurs and so forth. And let's bring you into this, Paul Franz. This is, you've made this into a kind of argument about what we suspect should be a meritocracy but is maybe a mythic notion and doesn't really exist.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question in terms of, you know, what the origins of this kind of phenomenon are. And I think something that's really easy to get lost in this, you know, the particulars of these cases and these individuals is that there's a much larger culture in Silicon Valley around, you know, this sense. And it's not just Silicon Valley. It's in a lot of these kind of communities in, you know, Boston, New York, Chicago, where there's this sense of kind of winner takes all, cheater be cheated. And that's something that we at Challenge Success are working with schools on because, you know, we see these particular students in this particular case, but there's this much, much deeper culture of kind of like this sense that if we don't go to these top schools, we're going to fail in life, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be the end for us. That's going to mean we're going to be poor. We're going to be sad. We're going to be unhappy throughout the rest of our lives. And that's just not borne out by the research. But that, I mean, it kind of, when I saw this story break, I was really struck by, the fact that it kind of showed this systemic, some of these systemic things that are going on in terms of, you know, unfair access and unequal opportunities, but also the sense that we, you know, we're kind of reinforcing this narrative that like, going to these elite schools is what really makes a difference in people's lives, and there's just not research that bears that out.
Well, there's a kind of research that says that, in fact, if you're a white male, you're not necessarily going to benefit by going to some of these name Ivy League schools or schools like Stanford. But if you are a female, on the other hand, a woman, or if you are, for that matter, a person of color, you can benefit.
That is true. There is,
and most of these are cases of white privilege, really, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely, and that is the case for some schools in very and the effect sizes tend to be very small for those things. And I think something that gets lost in that is that, you know, within school variation is so much larger than between school variation. And Raj Chetty has some great research that shows, you know, some of the best institutions for social mobility are not these elite schools, but are schools like the City University of New York, these broad, open access, high quality public universities.
But you think about kids. I happen to come from a working class background. You know, trying to get in through working hard academically to these named schools, make their parents proud and all of that. And it does enrage a lot of people who think that, you know, if you have money and if you have influence, and particularly if you have money, you can make a great deal of difference in your kid's future and get the status school if that's what you want to get. But there's also a number of other sides to this whole story with respect to, well, class differences and so forth. And that is that the argument is often put forward that universities and colleges favor students of color. And to some extent, that argument has certainly held up and been made valid by many. But the reality is we get a very different picture from this. We get a picture of wealth and privilege.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that this story does point to a lot of wealth and privilege. And I think that that's, you know, that's a really problematic aspect of our higher education system writ large. But I would emphasize that I think it's really easy to get caught up in this idea of this very small set of schools. I mean, there are over 4,000 colleges in the United States, and the number of them that are these highly selective, really prestigious schools is very small. And yes, they do give access to a lot of networks, but really, what makes a difference in students' lives is what they do when they're in college more than where they go. So, you know, if you are connecting with advisors, if you're doing the homework while you're at school, while you're in college, you're doing that learning and you're kind of getting the leg up that way. That's how you really see the value add. And a lot of the research in terms of, you know, what the value add is in terms of long-term income from going to college and also long-term life satisfaction. Gallup Purdue has this great survey of student experiences and post-college outcomes. And really, it is what you're doing while you're in college. And some of the schools that have the highest return on investment, Brookings does a great ranking system where, you know, they look at the highest return on investment. Where do you most expect to grow your income from attending these schools? And a lot of the schools near the top of that ranking are maritime academies and pharmaceutical schools that are really narrowly training people in these very high, you know, like high wage fields that require particular skills.
Yeah, some like to say it's more the individual maybe than the institution. And let's bring you into this, Julie Lithcott-Hames. What was your reaction to this story?
Frankly, Michael, I don't even know where to begin. I think, like everybody, I was stunned at the evidence, at the lengths, or the allegation that there is evidence, at the lengths some wealthy parents have gone to try to buy a spot for their kid at an elite place. I'm concerned about the extent to which this is sort of the ultimate in helicopter parenting, which has been the focus of my work over the last 7 years.
I think
years.
You call it drone parenting.
one of my colleagues at Stanford, Donovan, helped plant that term in my ear the other day. Drone parenting, where the parents are effectively the drone, picking up the package, which is the child, and delivering that package to the desired future, which is the quote-unquote right college, where literally the child has had nothing to do with it. They're just being transported to a new future that the parents have made possible. And I am deeply concerned about, obviously, about the ethics of the issue, but what is the impact on the mental health of that overparented child? But the piece that I want to mention more than any is something you've just alluded to, Michael, which is affirmative action and the rhetoric in America over decades that people like me, black and brown folks, have improperly been aided in getting to college, have been given spots that are really meant for white folks. I mean, I'm somebody who's personally been, you know, told that I didn't deserve my spot at Stanford, that I got it because I was black. And that's the American narrative about race and higher education. Well, what we learned 2 days ago is that however many small number of spots, and they are small, that are set aside to try to give opportunity, or not set aside, but, you know, there's a preference on giving us an opportunity to some Black and Brown and Native kids who haven't had the kind of leg up in life. Let's make sure we're giving them a look. Those number of spots pale in comparison to the number set aside for children of donors, children of legacies, and children who are athletes, all of whom are highly disproportionately white kids. And that athlete piece surprises people because people say, wait a minute, the football players and basketball players, they're not white. If you look at the number of NCAA athletes in any given year on a breakdown of race and gender, you will see that they are predominantly white kids. So what we've learned is that there's a tremendous preference given to folks who are white. And I think it upends this narrative about undeserving Black and Brown kids. And frankly, I'm glad to see this conversation happening.
Well, you've also said that you're concerned about the children, and many people are in this. Some of the children, I think, is as our guest here in studio, Leonardo, said, may indeed have been involved in the. We don't know all these narratives or all these stories, but for the most part, we know that the majority of them were not. And yet, it's probably going to be traumatic to these kids to find out what their parents were involved in here. And you have to ask, are they going to be, in fact, it's already happening. They're being bullied, those who have somehow been discovered and revealed on some campuses.
Well, they shouldn't be bullied. That's a terrible thing. I think the far greater harm is happening inside of them psychologically, regardless of whether they're being bullied. They've basically learned that their
this could be traumatic, right?
Is a fraud. Yeah, traumatic deeply to the psyche. Because when, look, this is the harm of helicopter parenting. When you, despite the best of intentions, when you're trying to manufacture a future for your child and deliver them to it, you're basically telling them, hey, kid, you're not capable of succeeding without me. I have to orchestrate your life to be a certain way or else you will fail. And that damages the psyche. Also, they literally have not developed the skills themselves to get them farther along the path in life. So they are actually less competent. They are less skilled when they've been overparented. I mean, this is the ultimate harm of overparenting. You arrive your kid at some future, and then they're bewildered when they're there because they haven't done the work to get themselves there.
You've also gone on record as saying these schools need to stop participating in these college ratings like U.S. News and World Report. They're harming the kids, and they're harming the whole nature of college admissions.
And they're offensive to the very concept of college, right? College isn't some brand name. It's not like buying jeans or a soda or a car where the brand name matters. You know, the college experience is a deeply enriching four-year process that develops a mind and develops a character and helps forge a human being into their adult self. And the fact that U.S. News and World Report commodifies it the way they do, such that colleges, in order to improve in the rankings, have to admit kids who have the highest SAT scores, leads to this insidious behavior. So in order to be, you know, top in U.S. News, you got to have freshmen in your class who have really high SAT scores. Well, who has the highest SAT scores? The people who can afford to do all the test prep over and over again and pay coaches and people like Singer, you know, to improve their kids' scores. It's basically a function of wealth. SAT score correlates with zip code. All right. If we could, if the big boys in college admission, the most highly selective schools, said we're going to refuse to participate in U.S. News because it's recognizing the wrong things, things that have nothing to do with the value of a college education, that system would implode, and I think the system could, the admission system could then sort of resettle itself, renorm itself around what did students actually do in high school, what do their recommenders say about them by way of effort and character, what do the students have to say for themselves in their essays, what do the interviews reveal. I mean, I think it's time, this ranking system, the time for it has come and gone. It is fomenting, it is fostering this obsession with the so-called elite schools, and I think we're seeing this, the really seedy underbelly of it.
Julie Lithcott-Hames with us is the author of How to Raise an Adult and Real American and former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford. And I heard you speak up, Paul Franz. I want to go to you in a moment, but I want to go to our callers, too. There are lots of them here. And before I go to you, Paul, let me just ask a quick question of you, Julie, since you're former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising. I mean, a lot of people see the real problem here having to do with just the numbers and the cutthroat nature of the competition. Acceptance rate last year at Stanford, 4.29%, the lowest in its history. Thoughts from you?
Well, one of my thoughts is it would be great if those who regulate the admissions community, and there is an informal self-regulation. But if they would gather themselves together and say, let's not let kids apply to 20 schools or 30 schools, let's cap it at 10, because part of what's happening here is some kids are applying to so many schools, it sort of overinflates the appearance of selectivity. If kids couldn't apply to so many schools, you'd have higher rates of admission at all of them. So that's part of the problem. It's an optics problem.
And Paul French, you wanted to add something here?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on what Julia is saying about the rankings, because that's something that in a recent paper we put out called A Fit Over Rankings, we looked at how those rankings work. And one of the things that I think people don't always understand is that they're really measuring, they're arbitrarily precise, and two, they're measuring inputs, not outputs. And I think that's something that Julia was getting at as well, is, you know, you're looking at like SAT scores and what, you know, is about the incoming class, but they're not actually measuring the quality of the schools. They're just measuring what kinds of students come to the school in the first place.
And a quick question, if I could, to you, Leonardo Castelleda. A listener wants to know, did any of these parents write off these donations on their taxes? Do we know the answer to that?
We do. It appears that they did. It appears that a lot of them routed their payments through the Key Worldwide Foundation, which was a nonprofit to ironically help underserved kids. And so it appears that a lot of them did write them off as charitable donations, which is kind of insult to injury, I think, for a lot of folks, seeing that they got, you know, a double benefit there.
Well, we have a lot of callers, as I said. And let's start with you, Christine. You're on the air. Good morning. Join us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I'm sitting here shaking my head over the fact that people wrote it off on their taxes, and it just compounds my original point, which is these folks have all of the benefits that are available lawfully, many of them unfair, but are legal, and still they insist on cheating. It is shocking, and not to make this political, but it does seem reminiscent of many of like Trump's decisions. Just we're learning about the essentially American aristocracy and the lengths they will go to get advantages. So,
well, if it's an aristocracy, like you're suggesting, it's one of wealth, and they are, you know, branding their kids, as was said earlier. And so who is the greatest brander of them all is our president. But let me thank you for that call. And let me get another caller aboard here, and that's Tatiana. Tatiana, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm a low-income Stanford grad, and I just want to make a comment from something I heard earlier. A lot of times we're talking about how hyper-competitive these environments are in, like, high-income schools and high-income zip codes, like, let's say, in Palo Alto, and how I heard earlier on one of the programs here, it's kind of like hand-to-hand combat for these high-income kids that might lead to the pressure to commit fraud. But I think we can't say that without pointing out how high pressure and how difficult it is for a low-income student who's working one or two jobs while supporting, you know, helping support the household and trying to make it to college without any knowledge or support of previous, you know, generation or social capital. And so I think that when we talk about the pressure felt by high-income students and high-income parents to commit fraud, we should also talk about the pressures that low-income students have to be able to even make it to college.
Yeah, Tatiana, I thank you for those thoughts. I appreciate hearing from you, and we'll hear from more of our listeners. If you're on the line, stay on. If you'd like to join us, you can do it at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Talking about college admissions bribery scandal, which has really rocked the nation's top schools. Leonardo Castaneda with us in studio from the Mercury News, and Paul Franz from Challenge Success, and Julie Lithgott-Hames, who's the author of How to Raise an Adult and Real American. And when we come back, we'll also hear from a Stanford student. So stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the college admissions scandal, and some comments are coming in, as well as a lot of calls. We'll get to as many of you who are waiting on the line as we can. But here's Neaton, who writes, the admissions scandal is not just an instance of corruption in admissions. It's a reflection of the unfairness in society overall. Merely scrutinizing the admissions process will not change things. And Todd tweets, aside from access to quality education, it's clear acclaimed colleges are as much about joining an elite club. Alumni look after their own. It's not surprising that some want to buy their way into the club. And Mike writes, why don't schools like Yale or Harvard increase enrollment rather than making admission so difficult? And let me bring another voice into this. Eunice Jung is joining us. She's a student at Stanford and a sophomore there. And Eunice, good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, well, we're pleased to have you here. And let's hear your thoughts. What do you hear on campus, and what's the response that you have?
Well, this has definitely been the talk of the town with all my friends. I'm sure every Stanford student has talked about this at least once a day. It's definitely not shocking. Actually, a lot of people are not surprised that this has happened on a large national scale. But what is important is that, like, instead of just focusing on the illegality of the story, right, we don't want to naturalize what is legal in the college admissions process. So this has been an opportunity for a lot of students of color, minority students, to voice and platform what they think about it, especially that there's already a stigma against those who have been accepted without bribe or without illegal funding. So there's already a stigma and some sort of like de-belonging that happens on campus. So using this outrage as this scandal as a platform to not only make like memes or jokes about it, but also insert their own voice and how their experience at Stanford is uniquely still exclusionary to them, is something that has empowered a lot of students to speak out for. So to recognize that those voices are still extremely legitimate and not get blanketed over the large discourse of like the illegal bribery practices, I think is extremely important to recognize.
Now, I'm assuming that you are of Chinese background, Chinese American background. Is that right?
No, I'm actually Korean-American.
Oh,
but
Korean. Okay.
To emphasize that, right, like I pretty much benefit off of the model of the college admissions process and just societally. So I want to like reiterate that I am very privileged when it comes to this discussion. So we need to like highlight the voices of those that aren't so much privileged and are always like underskirted or blanketed over when it comes to discourses around college admissions process.
Well, I thank you for joining us this morning, and the talk will probably continue. It will be the talk, as you said, of the town, or at least of Stanford, for some time going, and we're going to continue talking about it here. Thank you, Eunice. That's Eunice Jung, who is a student at Stanford and a sophomore, and we're going to go to more of your calls. Let me go next to down the South Bay in San Jose. Jim joins us. Jim, you're on. Morning.
Yeah, good morning. These families, I call between the top 2 and 5% of wealth in America, and I think it's wrong that we're focusing on these. The outrage, well, let's just start at the beginning. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. It's a bribe, it's a bribe, it's a bribe. Whether you could afford to put your name on a dormitory or a new chem lab for the science department, that is still a bribe. And we're focused with the outrage on these families that couldn't afford the brand new dorm building. If I remember correctly, the coach at Stanford didn't benefit personally from these funds. He actually applied it completely to the department. So it's not about bribing individual peoples. It's still going to the schools. And these elite universities should be in the business of higher learning, not higher endowments. And that's what it's about. And it is about these elite schools. It's not just the name. I disagree with your first caller that said that these kids are going to grow up and be confused at how did I get here. I don't see Jared Kushner confused at how he got where he did. I don't see how George Bush is suffering from George W. Bush. Bless his heart. How did he get into Yale? Come on. Now, this is a bigger issue. This is a travesty that the top 1% are getting away with bribing. That's my comment. I'd love
All right, and here. I will let that comment stand, and thank you for it. As I think our guest Paul Franz said at one point, colleges should be desperate to find the right kids or students as opposed to parents desperate to find the right college. But let me go. Did you want to say something here, Leonardo?
Yeah, I think he gets to this idea of the, again, the side door and the back door. And I think a lot of people feel like there should only be the front door because, you know, by definition, these side and back doors are, you know, limited by wealth, and the front door is kind of the only option a lot of lower-income minority students have available. So I think it gets to that idea.
It does, and we'll get to some more callers, and we'll go next to Matthew in Oakland. Matthew, join us.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Hi. So I actually wanted to address, before I get into my comment, one of your guests actually said that the brand of these elite colleges are really not a factor. And I absolutely disagree. I mean, when you look at, you know, the CEOs in this country and outside of the country, and more than half of, you know, our U.S. presidents, it's Yale, it's Harvard, it's all of these elite schools that really do carry a lot of weight behind their name. So to say that that doesn't matter and that the brand is being overblown or it doesn't carry any weight, I just disagree with that completely.
All right, but I'd like to hear your perspective because you're an African-American man raising a son. Is that right?
What I was saying is that basically coming up the way I did, I would absolutely, you know, pull any string that's possible to get my son into the exact same position. And, I mean, obviously, I wouldn't know until now that it was against the law, but fully acknowledging that you were bending some rules or even breaking some rules that might have repercussions, it's just so institutionalized. I mean, if you look back, I think a gentleman said it, the last caller said it, you know, presidents are donating buildings to these schools, you know, and getting their kids and their entire lineage into these elite schools. It's been happening since inception.
Yeah, I want to take what you're saying, actually, and thank you for it, and go to Paul Franz, because we are talking about illegality here, but we're also talking about people who will say, well, I'm Machiavellian because my kid is involved here. I'd do anything for my kid, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the caller point makes a good point, which is these brands. I don't want to say that the brands don't matter. I think what gets lost in that equation, it's really hard to test against what would happen if these same students had gone to a different school. And there has been some research in this kind of direction. Kruger, Stacy Dale, and Alan Kruger have tested like what happens when students who get into similar schools, who come from similar backgrounds, but then one of them chooses to go to a less selective school. The long term outcomes are basically the same. So the point being, it's not that, you know, the people who come from these tremendous places of privilege aren't benefiting from the schools per se, but I think the effect of the school they go to is much smaller than the effect of all of the other accumulated benefits over the course of their lives. It's not the college that's making the difference.
Excuse me, Paul, there was an article in The Atlantic which took some exception to what you're saying and said it's different for people of color. It's different for women. Women get married later and they make more money, and it's usually white men, as privileged as they might be and as exclusive as their pedigree might be, who are the ones who don't necessarily benefit, as you're arguing.
Yeah, no, and I think there's definitely something to that. And I think, if anything, that speaks to the need for a more equitable admissions process, because these schools are not making a difference for the kinds of students who are getting into them most often and most easily.
And some comments from listeners. Charlie writes, a rich and powerful play by their own set of rules. The only surprise is when once in a long while some of these parasites get busted. Strong sentiments there. Another listener says students who were admitted to colleges through their parents' bribery should be allowed to remain as long as they successfully perform throughout their education. There's no reason to punish them for their sins of their parents. What about that? Let me go to you on that, if I could, Julie Lithcott-Hames. I mean, there are some who are saying these students got in unfairly. They ought to be, even if they didn't know about it, they ought to be bounced.
Yeah, I think there is a difference between the kids who knew about it, the kids who know, hey, I'm not a kicker on a football team, yet I've been recruited to play kicker on a football team. They're obviously complicit in it, and I think they need to face strict penalties for that. For the students who truly had no idea, and facts would have to really be dug into on that, I think maybe, they do deserve a less harsh consequence. Michael, I have to jump in and say something else here, which is that, agreeing with so many of the callers, there's a woman we all need to know about. Kelly Williams Bowler, a black mother in Ohio, was trying to get her two black daughters to a better public school. She lived in Akron, and she sent them to school kind of across the bridge, if you will, sort of the equivalent of coming from East Palo Alto to Palo Alto, and so her kids could get a better education. And she was found out, and she was jailed, and she was convicted of a felony for trying to get her kid to a better public school. Okay? This is what happens to black and brown people trying to get to secure a better future for their children. Look what happens to them in the criminal justice system compared to what we all fear might happen with these incredibly wealthy white folks who have bought their kids this kind of future. It just points to the disparity and the dichotomy when it comes to how people are treated differently, how people are treated on the basis of race in this country.
There's another dimension to this, though, that we haven't even touched upon. It's one that interests me, and that is a lot of people like to brag about where their kids go to college. You know, my kid's at Yale and my kid's at USC or wherever it might be. That plays a pretty significant role here, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A parent's ego is at the heart of these practices. These are parents. Looking at the parents who have been indicted, they are wealthy, they are connected, they are celebrities, they're important in their fields. And what they're saying is, I need to show everybody how amazing I am by attaching this brand name to my child's life. And frankly, I think it's about their own need for further validation. They've already got all the privilege in the world. Why they feel the need to try to confer even more upon it by buying spots for their children is beyond me.
Interesting question here from Nancy, and let me go to you on this, if I may, Leonardo. She says, does anyone know who the whistleblower was on this story?
So as far as we know, and this will be interesting in the coming months, is that this was actually found out through an unrelated investigation. We don't know what they were investigating. Maybe it has something to do with college athletics, since that was one of the common ties along these things. But we do know that eventually Singer cooperated, as well as a couple other people who
Well, they apparently had the goods on Singer. That's why he wanted less than a sentence, presumably.
Yeah, but I don't think, you know, some parent have a, it doesn't sound like a parent have a pang of conscience and called up the FBI. It sounds like they maybe stumbled across this and started unraveling.
And here's David, who says, what's the difference between giving $1 million to set up an endowed chair, which will pretty much guarantee your kid is admitted, and simply giving $50,000 directly to the dean to get your kid admitted? Why is one legal and one illegal? We go to you on that, Paul Franz?
I mean, I cannot speak to why that's legal or not legal. I mean, I do want to, in response to that, you know, talk about, again, like kind of this idea of you know, why are we putting so much attention and focus on these elite schools and thinking about their endowments in particular and how much money they raise? I mean, something that one of my favorite little factoids about kind of the ecosystem of higher education is, you know, so much news coverage, so much attention, so much money is given to these Ivy League schools, for example. But the actual enrollment of the University of Texas system is higher than the entire Ivy League combined. So, you know, you talk about Julie's telling this story about, you know, students trying to get ahead in life. And like, really, the schools that are making the difference for the majority of Americans are the University of California, the University of Texas, you know, California State Universities, you know, these big state schools that are serving the vast majority of students, whereas the Ivy League is serving this very small portion of students and yet raises so much money. And I would push, you know, people who are donating to those schools, think about, you know, maybe their money makes a bigger difference if they start donating to those state schools instead.
Okay, let me get another caller. Brett, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to kind of touch on some of the stuff I've been listening to. From what it seems to me, it's a very large lack of ethics amongst these people, whether or not the administrators or the people donating for these purposes of getting their kids into these schools. My family, we're, you know, working class in San Jose, California here, and I'm the first of 15 cousins in my entire family that actually went and graduated to college. I was accepted to a college that I couldn't afford simply by virtue of my parents making too much money, but my parents didn't pay for me to go to school and wouldn't pay for me to go to school. So I wound up having to go to my local university and graduated there just fine. But just considering the things of the affordability of schools and colleges and the greater education in California and America itself is, you know, what could have been, what might have been the access to the programs and other classes I might have had access to if I was able to afford it. But by virtue of my heritage, I'm denied any sort of assisted educational funding.
And you feel what about that, Brett?
I feel like I'm, you know, cheated out a little bit. Like, yeah. I'm just simply because of where I was born and the color of my skin, I'm denied things just based on that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for letting us know your thoughts on that, and I appreciate hearing from you. We're going to hear from as many as we can, as I said earlier, but let me read a comment here. Going to hear from Ron here, who writes, please also discuss the issue of incredible expectations by parents in high schools such as Gunn High School that sometimes lead to suicide. There's an entire system where the influence of school reputation plays a role in future work opportunities. That's certainly true. And Julie Lucott Hames, talking about Gunn, I mean, that's down in your territory there. And there were, we've covered it on forum, suicides that were very concerning to the community and to many people who were concerned about these young people who felt so driven and so under pressure. That's a big part of this, isn't it?
Michael, that's the school right down the street from my house, the school my son graduated from and my daughter is currently at as we speak. So this is an issue near and dear to my heart. The problem in our community in Palo Alto, and it's replicated across the country and in other privileged places, is that our definition of success, which Challenge Success really works hard to turn around. Our definition of success is so narrow that our kids feel their entire worth is some summation of their grades and scores and accolades and awards, etc. And it leads a small number of kids in our community to feel a degree of helplessness and hopelessness about their chance at controlling any of this, that they decide life is not worth living. And far more than those who actually take their lives or attempt to take their lives are the students in the thousands who are impacted at the level of their mental health, their anxiety, their depression, all of which are on the rise in communities like Palo Alto and the Greater Bay Area, because you know we've basically made them feel that your purpose as a kid is to get into the right college, and you need to be perfect to get into the right college. And as Paul has said, this definition of right college is so narrow and should be much broader. As your callers have said, plenty of great educations are to be had at public schools and at city colleges. There are so many definitional problems here. If we could widen the definitions and change the narrative, we could calm things down and make life easier for kids, give more opportunity to all kids. I mean, it's time for a reckoning.
We also ought to remember the fact that a lot of those entrepreneurs and successful people down in Silicon Valley went to city colleges or state colleges, and some of them didn't even, I mean, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, for example, weren't even college educated. So,
well, you know what? Steve Jobs went to my favorite small liberal arts college for a while, Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Right.
And I'm mentioning Reed because Reed refuses to participate in U.S. News because they know it's BS, and they take the rating hit that comes. U.S. News will make up your SAT scores if you, the college, don't send them. And so they're lower down in the rankings because U.S. News dings them for not participating, but they refuse because they know it's BS. Steve went there, and we have fonts on our computers because Steve Jobs took a calligraphy class at Reed. I'm proud to say my son is a sophomore at Reed. I graduated from a big brand name college called Stanford, and I'm proud to have gone to Stanford. But I'm equally as proud of the fact that my kid's at a small liberal arts college most people haven't heard of, because I know he's getting a fantastic education there.
Now, people who know anything about pedagogy, and especially innovative pedagogy, know Reed. It's right at the top of the food chain, but I mean, prestigiously.
But not for many parents. Many parents haven't heard of it, and they just think, why would you send your kid there? You know, it's not in the U.S. News top 20.
No, understood. But I said that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were not college educated. I meant they were not college graduates. They didn't have baccalaureate degrees.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But you're getting some pretty strong responses on this, as you might imagine. Listen to what Bernie has to say. He says, this rigged system of Ivy League oligarchs sitting at the top will only last as long as the rest of us play into it. Let's stop giving preference and deference to the graduates of elite schools in our employment and elections. Don't employ them, don't vote for them, and the system will change. And we'll get to more of your calls. Let me go next to Los Gatos. And Mike, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a high school senior going through the college finishing the college application process right now.
My sympathies.
And, thank you. So basically, a lot of the kids in my class have been talking about how like the system's rigged and how it's unfair that these like rich kids are getting there and we're not. But I think what's more important is that things like the Common App and like the UC app, where you can just click like 25 schools on your thing, is ridiculous, and it's just making the acceptance rates lower, and it makes it hard for people who don't have the perfect GPA and SAT to get into a school that they would actually want to go to. So like, for I only applied to about 6 schools, which is high for me, but like for a lot of people, that I was like the lowest, and I got denied from my dream school. I wanted to go to UC Davis, and a lot of my friends who applied to 25 schools got in, and they're like, I already declined my offer. And I'm like, look, why did you apply to a school that you don't want to go to? Like, this is ridiculous. You can only go to one. Why did you apply to 30 schools? That's just ridiculous. It's making the acceptance rates lower, and then it makes people think, oh, I'm one of the 4% that got into Stanford. I'll pay, you know, $80,000 a year to go there. It's a total scam.
Have any advice for this young man, Paul Frenz?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I sympathize so much. I was a middle school teacher for many years, and I've taught at high school level as well. And, I mean, my heart goes out to students who have to live in this system, because the narrative that they're exposed to, the stories they're told, the kind of the culture in the schools, and Julie was talking about this too, is so intense. And I think, you know, things like this scandal in a weird way actually reinforce the kind of this narrative of like, we need to go to these elite schools. I would push back against the idea of the dream school. I mean, I think that there are so many excellent places to get an education in the United States. And, you know, I'm sorry that this particular student didn't get into UC Davis. That is an excellent school. He's going to go somewhere else that's also going to be an excellent school, and he's going to get a great education as long as he puts the work in there. I think that that's where we really harm kids is by telling them, like, if you don't get into this, you know, school X, then you've failed in some sense. And it's like, you haven't failed. There are so many good fits in this country, and we have such a actually strong system of higher education and so many excellent schools. I mean, even the community colleges in California are excellent places to start your education, and then you can transfer into the UCs, or you can just get an associate's degree. And I mean, a large number of the engineers in Silicon Valley are, you know, just went to this Foothill De Anza system. So there's a lot to be said for not just pinning your hopes on that individual school, because really it's not the name of the school and it's not the institution you go to. There are, I want to push on the idea of the perfect fit. There are, for every student, there are probably dozens of fits that would be really good for them.
Well, Mike, we wish you the best of luck. I hope you get into a school which not only is challenging, but certainly enhancing of your life and your future. And thank you for that call. Here's a listener who writes, why aren't the universities being sued? You want to address that, Leonardo?
Why aren't they? Well, so as of this morning, they are. A couple students at Stanford are filing the start of a class action lawsuit against some of these universities, claiming that when they applied, they didn't know that the application system was rigged and that people were able to essentially buy spots as they see it. They're also suing Stanford because as far as we know, no students actually got into Stanford through this process. The student that was involved with the sailing coach didn't actually enroll there. But they're saying now their degree is devalued because people will look at them and wonder, well, did you get into Stanford on merit or did you get in because, you know, someone paid $50,000 or $100,000? So I think we are going to start seeing some lawsuits from, you know, graduates who feel like now they'll always have this hanging over their head of did they get in on, you know, thanks to rich mom and dad or on their own merit. Yeah,
who would have thought an albatross going to Stanford? But here's a listener who writes, I wonder how many families who bribe elite colleges to illegally, quote, give their kids the best chance in life also support building a wall to prevent families from illegally giving their kids the best chance in life. And we'll go to more of your calls. And let's go next to Windsor and welcome Dan. Dan, you're on forum. Good morning.
Hello. I was very interested in this topic, and thanks for taking my call. I finished my degree with a university without walls arrangement in Massachusetts, and I had been through several schools just trying to find direction, and it really brings the question that students are, you know, sent to schools with really little direction, and that they really have to find their direction. And often, you know, the lower-cost schools, community colleges are excellent. I've had some of my best experiences at community colleges. Excuse me. But the whole idea of challenging the brick-and-mortar college idea and concept compared to what's real education for people. And I found that the way I finished, having to find my own learning resources, was far superior than just taking classes at a predetermined classes.
Well, it worked well for you, and you're giving that testament, and it's good to hear from you, and I thank you for the call. Bricks and mortar do fit into this picture. As far as alternatives, non-bricks and mortar, we'll go to another caller. Deborah, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I have two daughters who graduated college last year, one who is a freshman this year. None got into the UCs, even though we've lived and paid taxes here forever. One who went to what she originally considered a second-tier state school actually has the best job of her entire peer group, that, you know, her social group that she's known in her whole life. And she just put her all into school, and she knew what she wanted to do, and took advantage socially as well as academically, and then put her efforts into networking, and she's doing great. You know, so it's about who you are on the inside, and believing in yourself, and selling yourself, and you will get to where you want to go.
Yeah, nicely said, Deborah, and thank you for that. Encouraged to hear those kind of testaments. In fact, here's one from a listener named Alfredo who says, kids should not feel ashamed about going to community college. I did it, and I'm now working at NASA Ames. I even have grads from Stanford and MIT reporting to me. NASA actually encourages that experience. And we'll encourage another caller to join us here, and that's you, Paul. You're on. Morning.
Hello. I wondered if the guests would address the fact that our UCs especially are having to accept more and more foreign and out-of-state students because of the divestment of the state into our colleges. 30 years ago, it was something like 70% of the cost of our universities were covered by our tax money, and today it's less than 20. And it may have something to do with Prop 13. It may not, but it seems like we're selling access to our UCs, which were, like the previous caller said, always meant for the descendants of our taxpayers and so that they could have the best opportunity. I went to UC San Diego, and our school was 20% Chinese national from China. One in five of my classmates was from China, and frankly, a lot of them didn't cut the lettuce, if you will.
Cut the lettuce. Well, that's a new one on me. Paul, no, thank you for that call. It's certainly come up in these discussions we've had about the rise of costs and universities. You get more money from foreign students, more bang for the buck to the institution, but there are students who lose spots because of it. We're going to have to leave it at that because we have run out of time here, and I want to thank our guests. Thank Leonardo Castaneda here in studio, reporter for the Mercury News Bay Area News Group. Thank you, Leonardo.
Thank you.
And thanks, Paul Franz, research associate with Challenge Success. Good to have had you.
Thank you, Michael.
And thanks, Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of her latest book, How to Raise an Adult and Real American. Thank you, Julie.
My pleasure.
And thanks to Eunice Jung, who a student from Stanford who joined us earlier. Thanks to all of our behind-the-scenes people, our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Ariana Prell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. You can continue this discussion online at kqed.org/forum. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.